Robert got a ride to Cambridge for the long weekend over fall break with Dawson Dean. David Hendler was out of town on a long trip to Europe, so Robert spent most of his time with Paul Graham. Andy Suddeth, who was rowing that weekend in the head of the Charles race, was around too. It was like old times. Robert sat upstairs glued to one of the workstations. Paul was sitting downstairs in the office of David Mumford, an eminent mathematician on the Harvard faculty, whose office Paul occasionally used when Mumford wasn't around. Early Saturday evening, Robert walked into Mumford's office, wearing his trademark smirk. Paul knew something was up. Robert was pacing furiously. He announced that he had been reading Unix source code and had found a big bug in FTP, the file transfer program that enables users to copy files from machine to machine over a computer network. The hole enabled someone to read or write any file on the target computer. From the level of Robert's excitement, Paul got the impression that he had just discovered this hole a few minutes earlier and was bursting to tell someone. Robert's pacing in the small office picked up. Encountering Mumford's desk at the end of one of his paces, instead of turning around again, Robert walked straight ahead and paced atop the desk. It was a sure sign that he was completely lost in his discovery. "RTM, you're on Mumford's desk!" Paul cried as he watched his friend's sneakers shuffle the papers on Mumford's desk. "Oh," Robert replied, and descended from the desk. At first, Paul wasn't sure what Robert was driving at. It sounded like just another way of breaking into Unix. "Well, that's an amusing hole, but what's the point?" he asked. "I could use this hole to write a virus," Robert explained. He said that for much of the fall term at Cornell, he had been thinking about writing a virus, one that would spread slowly over the internet. As Robert described it, the virus wasn't going to do anything malicious, and certainly would not destroy data. In the end, it should do nothing at all except spread to as many machines as possible. Paul was immediately intrigued. He had been badgering Robert all semester to make more friends at Cornell and improve his social life, but when he heard that such efforts had been deferred in favor of something as intriguing as this computer virus, he was delighted and envious. "That's really great!" Paul was getting just as worked up as Robert. "You should do this for your dissertation." Paul was, in some ways, the perfect friend. When he got excited about an idea, his support was all the encouragement one needed to keep going. He could pull others into his excitement just by virtue of his own enthusiasm. Especially when it came to his friend and role model, RTM, Paul was a one-man cheerleading squad. When Robert began to talk about the virus he was planning, Paul's enthusiasm tripped into high gear. It must have had its effect even on the usually placid and low-key Robert. Robert had meant to keep his virus plans to himself. By telling Paul, of all people, Robert must have gotten both a validation for his idea and a stronger sense of urgency. Had he told anyone else about it, such as Nick or Andy or David, they might have been less encouraging. They would probably have suggested he simulate the experiment first, perhaps by running it on a smaller network that had been disconnected from the internet at large. Safety measures like that would keep the virus from affecting the entire network in case it contained an error. But a controlled environment would have made it a more modest and less scientifically interesting experiment. Robert wanted a large proving ground. Paul and Robert went to meet Andy for dinner that night at Legal Seafoods, a restaurant across the street from MIT, frequented by programmers and engineers. While Paul and Robert were standing outside waiting for Andy to arrive, the subject of the virus came up again. Since neither Paul nor Robert knew of anything like this having been done before, thinking about it required a lot of creativity. Both of them thought the idea sounded like the kind of great hack that was often dreamed up in the computer world. Robert started thinking out loud, describing to Paul some of the more important features such a program would require. First, of course, it would spread through the network, secretly planting itself in many different machines. An important goal was to make the virus as inconspicuous as possible, so as not to arouse suspicion from system managers. Once it had taken up residence, it would need a means of knowing whether or not another copy was already present, and it would have to regulate itself in order to limit the number of copies in each computer. But a different question was still unresolved: how to limit the growth without halting it completely. While they waited, Robert sketched out his ideas. The virus would enter a computer through the Unix loopholes he had found, and look around the system for any possible copies. If it found one, the two would talk to each other and decide what to do. Ideally, one would automatically stop running in order to limit growth, But what if someone discovered the virus and tried to trick the incoming virus into believing that a copy was already running on the machine it approached? A programmer could design a decoy to fool the invader into thinking that a copy already existed on a computer. Such a program, easy to write, could prevent the virus from spreading, serving the same purpose as a biological vaccine. Thinking like chess players, Robert and Paul decided that there would have to be a countermeasure against potential defensive programs. How could they fool the decoy? Why, randomization, of course. They had taken a graduate course together in efficient algorithms taught by Michael Rabin, a prominent mathematician and cryptologist. The concept of randomization was big with Rabin, who told his students again and again that if a problem seemed impossible to solve, they should reduce it to a simpler one and apply randomization. This was the philosophy behind Bob Morris's probabilistic typo checker. Rabin had discussed randomization as it applied to abstract problems, such as prime number searches, but it occurred to Paul and Robert that they could use the concept in the virus program. When the program entered and detected another copy, it would toss an electronic coin to decide which one should stop running. Another way of ensuring the virus's survival occurred to Robert. 1 in n times, the virus should enter a computer, forget about the electronic coin toss, and simply command itself never to stop running. But then came a new question. What should n be? 5? 1,000? 10,000? Just as they were beginning to ponder this, Andy walked up. Although he was a close friend, his job as a system manager at Aiken would place him in an awkward position, to say the least, if he were suddenly privy to discussions of huge security holes in Unix. Andy thought the conversation had ended abruptly because his friends were discussing a woman in whom both Andy and Robert were interested. Robert was still thinking about the virus, and he couldn't contain his enthusiasm for discovery of the FTP bug. The next day, he walked into Andy's office at Aiken and casually told him about it. Just as casually, he told him not to spread it around. Andy didn't waste much time before attempting to verify the bug. When he couldn't, Robert had to give him a more explicit description of how it worked.